Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. In this episode, we have the privilege of speaking with patient advocate Paul Ferris, former footballer and physiotherapist for Newcastle United, barrister and author. Paul has also come through his own prostate cancer journey and is here to share it today.
I'm delighted to welcome former Newcastle United winger Paul Ferris to our podcast today. He has successfully forged a post-football career as a physio, a barrister, and then a CEO. And he wrote a book called The Magic in the Tin. And I'm sure Paul might tell us a little bit about that. His story evolves from there. But Paul was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he tells his story in a very powerful way, with great grit and resilience, openness and profound bravery. So Paul, you're very welcome today. At the age of 51, you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Tell me what happened in your life from there.
It was a huge shock to me and to Geraldine, I think, who'll be joining us later, Helen. I just dealt with, I had a heart attack, an unexpected heart attack, which I'd written the first book about, called The Boy in the Shed. Between getting that book, finishing the manuscript and getting that book published, I found myself in the urologist's office and I barely sat down, and he said, I think you have a significant prostate cancer. And I was having some tests previously, but still the moment when he tells you that you've got a significant prostate cancer is quite a bolt. And I write in the book that he was actually sitting between me and Geraldine at the time, and I would have done anything to push him out of the way just to get to her for a moment. It just that moment, I've often heard other people talk about it. That moment is just, I still feel sick thinking about it, the moment when you hear that. And what it might mean. And I kind of had had conversations with him previously that it might be an enlarged prostate, and you kind of live in that hope and you think, oh, I'm going to be the one that has the enlarged prostate and not the prostate cancer. So once he said you have prostate cancer, your first thoughts really are, am I going to die? Am I going to die too young? Am I going to die too soon? Is it going to be serious? Is it going to be mild? Where am I? And that's where the tests came in to try and get me to a point where I would know what treatment path I would take. So you're kind of in the hands of him at that point and where he wants to send you. In my case, he sent me for an MRI scan, and then he sent me for a template biopsy, which obviously confirmed the diagnosis that I had prostate cancer in both lobes of my prostate and over 50% of my prostate. Mm-hmm. And then he laid out the options for me, did a bone scan to make sure it wasn't anywhere else, and said, look, in your case, you're 51. I think you only have two treatment options. I think one is to have your prostate removed, because I think it's localized. And I think the other case for you is to have radiotherapy and hormone treatment. Both will have hopefully the same positive outcome for you, and both come with side effects, and you need to sit down with an oncologist and weigh up your options. But actually, what's not an option for you at 51 is to ignore this. And what's not an option is for us to watch it. So kind of my choice, I felt like my choice was almost a Hobson's choice. It was kind of, go down this route, have your prostate removed, and there's some side effects that are going to follow that. Have your radiotherapy and hormone treatment, and there's some side effects that follow that. But actually, both are quite similar, the side effects. Yeah. And actually, I looked at it, and rightly or wrongly, I think the prognosis was good for both options. And I did, I think, what most young men do, and opted for to have my prostate removed. That fear of cancer being inside your body.
It's like having it cut out.
Well, exactly. And I looked, and I sat with a brilliant oncologist who's still my oncologist, who gave me all the outcomes of the other route. And I think at one point there was a trial that was available for me, which may have been shortened the radiotherapy treatment. And I went home, and every part of me thought, oh, do the trial, because that's like going to be the fastest route. And then there's this thing in the back of your mind, thing, just get this thing cut out, just get it cut out. And that's kind of what dominated my thoughts, and I talked about it with my wife, and talked about it with Geraldine, and we decided that we would have the prostate removed, hopefully get rid of it, and then deal with the side effects after.
Yeah. And tell me, Paul, it's something we mentioned in our first episode, that men like yourself who've been told that you have a prostate cancer and you've been given options, it can be difficult and maybe a little bit frustrating for the specialist to be saying to you, you need to go away now and make your mind up about which treatment you think is most suitable for you. How did you feel about that?
Mine was interesting, because he said to me, go away, have a think about it, but don't think about it for too long. because what had actually happened, Helen, with me was, which is just, I think it's human error and these things happen, but I'd gone to my GP 6 months previously with some urinary problems, and I'd had a PSA blood test, and it showed that my PSA was high and outside the bell curve, and there was and I had another one straight afterwards for my own, just for me, because I didn't quite believe it, and that was high as well. And then they put me on, I think it was a fast track, and they said you'll get a letter from the hospital in 2 weeks. About a week later, I got a letter from the hospital, and it said you'll be seeing a consultant in a week. And then I got another letter the next day to say, oh, ignore that letter, you'll get another one, another. And now that was kind of in the April time. Then I never got the other letter. If I just got on with my life, I thought, oh, I mustn't be a fast track person after all. And I read about it in The Magic in the Tin. We were in America at a Coldplay concert, and I went to try and have a pee, and I just couldn't pee. And I thought, oh, there's something. What happened to that letter? So by the time I'd gone to see the urologist, and I said, I just sat down in his office, and he said, you have a significant cancer. That was from the PSA test 6 months before. So there was a bit of disbelief in me. I was kind of almost a bit angry, saying, how can I have been floating about for 6 months, and then this happens? So in my case, I didn't think about it too long, because I knew I'd already had a 6 month period where I'd lost sometimes.
Yeah.
I actually was in, that was December when I sat with the urologist, and I had my prostate removed in I think it was late January. I didn't hang about for too long.
But Paul, there's a real lesson there, isn't there? You know, just because you don't hear from the hospital doesn't necessarily mean everything is okay.
Absolutely.
I suppose there's a sense of, you know, responsibility on a person as well, isn't there, to a degree? Not that I'm pointing fingers or anything, but there is a certain element of responsibility to follow up, I suppose, on what you knew already was maybe an issue in terms of a high PSA.
You're absolutely right. And I talk to people now about that scenario, and the first thing people say is, oh, did you not, are you not going to see the hospital? Do you not think this was, and I said, no, hang on a second. I had the PSA, I had two PSA tests as well, twice. And there is responsibility. Human error happens, administration is not an exact science. So in my case, I was frustrated with myself that because I was still having the same problems I'd gone to the doctor with. They haven't gone away. They were getting worse. They're getting worse to the point where I mentioned being in America at that concert. I was standing in a urinal, and I read about it in The Magic in the Tin, and I stood there desperate to go, and I just couldn't. Nothing came.
Scary time.
And I just thought, oh my God, I've never had that. That's never happened before. And then I'm watching the rest of this Coldplay concert in Massachusetts, and been this great thing with my family, having this great moment with my family at 1 minute. And then 20 minutes later, I'm looking up and thinking, there's something seriously wrong with me here. And I couldn't wait to get home.
So a big lesson learned there, isn't there?
Absolutely.
For everybody listening, you know, never ignore the signs and symptoms, you know, warning shot, high PSA level, waiting for a letter in the post.
And even if I did,
it happens.
Yeah, and even if you do the first bit, like I did the first bit I did the first bit as fast as anybody would ever do, because I previously had a heart attack, and I understood the importance of getting in there. So I'd done that bit, but actually it wasn't, in my case, it wasn't enough. I should have just been much more proactive, because even Helen, when I was trying to find out what happened to my letter, you know, I had to spend half a day. And I contacted one place, and they said, oh, you're in the wrong place here. I contacted someone else, and eventually I got to the private secretary of a urologist, who said, oh, sorry, you've just been missed off the system. And I got an appointment a week later.
Well, good. I'm delighted to hear that. And then, Paul, you said to me very quickly, you had your surgery. So you had your prostate removed, as we said earlier. You had it cut out because you felt like that was the best treatment for you, I suppose, the modality of treatment, but also... And in your mind, you wanted it cut out.
Yes, and that was the, and actually, I write again when I talk about the book, and people say I write about not paying as much attention to the side effects, the possible side effects of what I was going to be left with. Actually, because all I was, I think I heard them, and I talk about this. I talk about it, and I'll say, actually, in the book, I talk about it. At the doctor, the urologist, I'm sure, on several occasions said to me, if you have your prostate removed, you will be, clearly you'll be impotent. You may have erectile dysfunction. You may be incontinent, and there may be some penile shrinkage. And I actually write about it in the book. On the day I was having my prostate removed, he actually wrote penile shrinkage down. It was the first time I looked at it and thought, oh my God, pardon the irony, but that's a pretty big one. I kind of was that obsessed with getting my prostate removed that I didn't really hone in on the side effects until I was dealing with the side effects.
I think from my own experience of being, you know, a nurse specialist in the area, that's how it was. Like, cancer control was top priority.
Yes.
For everybody, for man and woman, you know, partner, wife, it was a top priority. Of course it is. Cancer control is really important. And then came, you know, probably if we rank them, it's different for different people, but it might have been incontinence and then erectile dysfunction, you know. And you're so right. Until you're faced with, you know, some of those issues like incontinence or erectile dysfunction, the most motivating factor is, in order to manage incontinence, is to be incontinent.
Yeah.
And the same applies for erectile dysfunction, you know. So you've displayed it really well there. And you got to a point where you'd had your surgery. How was I suppose, the, you know, the aftermath of having the surgery and the histology and follow-up? How did that go for you?
Yeah, it was so traumatic for me. I got a book out of it. It was pretty traumatic. I actually had we went home with the catheter in, as you do, and you've got a week with your catheter in, which is not a pleasant thing anyway. But during the week with the catheter, in my case, by the middle of the week, rather than getting better, I had some spasms and things that people sometimes get, but during the week, rather than getting better, I was feeling a lot worse. And sort of by the end of the week, I joke about it in the book, and I say to Jordan, I actually don't like the smell of you. The smell, you're making me feel sick. And she said, oh, thanks very much. You know, so I phoned a doctor and they said, look, you're going to the hospital on Monday to get your catheter removed. Mention that to them, and I'll not give you the long-winded version, but we popped into the hospital on the Monday with Geraldine, and there were two gentlemen sitting opposite us who had catheters in, who were there for the same reason as me, had their prostate removed a week ago, and they were going to get their catheters out. And I was a bit grey around the gills, feeling really ropey, and I said, John, there's something not right here. But as I say, I'll give you the short version. I had my catheter removed, was sent into the bathroom to have a pee, tried to have a pee, the world started to spin, collapsed on the floor, and I found myself back in the ward, and I had sepsis and anemia. And that was quite you kind of expect to have your surgery and then it'd be a smooth, lovely path and away you go, but actually, it's not always that. And mine, I don't want to tell horror stories, but mine wouldn't be your typical journey. It's just one of those things that, again, I'm philosophical about it. I understand it's one of those things that happens. It just happened. I'm glad I was in the hospital being pumped full of antibiotics for sepsis. Yeah. You know, and when they said to me, you have anemia, I said, look, are you sure? Because I'm Irish and I'm a bit white and a bit blue anyway. And they said, no, you're definitely got a problem there. So I that bit was a very, the first bit after the surgery was very unpleasant. But then once that passed, your biggest concerns then, you're probably not thinking about, as you say, you're not thinking about erectile dysfunction so soon afterwards. You're kind of thinking about, you realize you're incontinent. And you realize you're incontinent. But talking about incontinence is one thing. Being incontinent is very different. I'm sure a lot of men, a lot of women who've had children will know it, but it's actually a really sickening moment when you actually realize you can't control. You're sitting having a chat with someone and you can think, oh, hang on, I've just peed a bit here. And I think that's quite a sobering thought. So I work really hard. I work really hard on the continence issue, and I got continent very quickly.
And that happens mostly for men, I suppose. Like just to say, like it can be such a torment in the initial phases, and the uncertainty of knowing whether you're going to recover, you know, and gain control again, is actually in your mind probably constantly. But for most people, they you know, within a year, it varies differently for different people. But I would say generally within a year, most people are dry anyway. So it's just good to bear that in mind.
That's exactly where I was. Yeah. And actually, when you asked about the journey that I ended up being on, I got myself continent. The erectile stuff never, in my case, they spurred the nerves to my penis because I was a young man. That was the whole idea, the prostatectomy. But actually, whatever happened for me, it just didn't work. Nothing came back. That was a devastating blow at that time. And then you talk to nurses and doctors and they would say things to you like, well, you know, you can still be intimate. You know, you can still be intimate without an erection, and you can still have an orgasm without an erection. And I write about it in the book. It's all very well saying an orgasm without an erection.
Yeah.
And being intimate with someone, and I don't mean this to be... I'm trying to be as sensitive as I can around this. Two people in a room being intimate, and then one of them's a man, or both of them's a man, an erection's a pretty important indicator that you want to be in the room. and for both parties, and so that was that I struggled with, and I still struggle with. But in my case, unfortunately, I went for my first PSA test after the surgery, and the consultant just said to me, "Look, your PSA is undetectable, which is great. However, we've got your pathology back, and there was a positive margin on your." And then that instantly gives you that feeling in your gut. And he said, "Let me worry about the positive margin. Your PSA rises again in 3 months' time, and again, then we'll have to consider some radiotherapy for you." And that's actually what happened. My PSA rose again and again, and I found myself back to the oncologist who gave me the option in the first place of having that journey. And he said, "You're going to have both now, because you're going to have the radiotherapy and the hormone treatment as salvage radiotherapy."
Yeah.
And interesting for you, in this field, I read about it in the book. Words like salvage just absolutely killed me, because I'm thinking salvage is like, there's a wreckage here. We're trying to save what we can. So I ended up having hormone treatment before the radiotherapy, and then have the radiotherapy, which kind of made me incontinent again.
Yeah, double whammy.
It was a real blow for me, and a real sickening blow for me. It also made me realize that any nerves that had been spared in my penis were now non-existent anyway. And then the big thing, and one of the reasons why I didn't do the surgery, the radiotherapy route in the first place, was I knew the hormone treatment would affect my libido. But I didn't really want that to be 51, and not only not be capable of having sexual relations, but not want to have sexual relations, and not even have the feeling. And actually, that's kind of where I am. And I ended up that way anyway. And that's where the book, and I have to tell you, the book's called The Magic in the Tin, Helen, because the magic in the tin is about my granddaughter and seeing the magic, and she has a magic tin at home. And the magic in the tin is about being willing to see the good in life after being kicked a couple of times. So it's not all misery here. I don't want to appear like a...
No, and absolutely.
I'm grateful for where I am, because some men don't get...
Yeah, and I hear all that, Paul, and it's nice for you to emphasise it, I think, as well, because, like, we'll go back a little bit to the incontinence and you know, I, in fact, go back to having two forms of treatment, which I'm sure was like devastating to hear that, you know, you needed to go down that route after having surgery. But I wonder, you know, just for listeners as well, it doesn't happen to everybody. Generally, the surgery, you know, works really well and margins are clear and, you know, it's a very curable type of cancer. And we need to remember that. And the survival rates at 5 years are like up in the 94%. But we're talking about you today, Paul, and considering, you know, that you had surgery, I can imagine, but I'm going to ask you that you didn't regret having the surgery, or did you?
You know, it's one of those things that this has to all be taken in with where you are, so you can go back in hindsight and talk about it. But with where you are and where I am in life now, knowing what I know now, maybe I would have been. Maybe when the doctor was talking to me, I might have pushed back a little bit and said, "Can we hold off till the surgery for the moment? Let's just watch and see what happens here." Even because as a patient, I think you have got a voice as well. And I think maybe I didn't appreciate that I had a role in that as much as that. And I regard myself as someone who would be willing to have that conversation, but I wasn't. I guess speaking now, Helen, I saw my oncologist last week, and since my radiotherapy and my hormone treatment, I'm now 4.5 years completely undetectable. So and I know I'm in a great place. And the sickening feeling after my surgery of a PSA rising was a horrible place to be. Now I'm speaking to my oncologist, and he says, "Actually, you know, I now recognize, Paul, how your cancer is how it's behaving. So even if it were to come back for you, I think you're in a very long journey now, and I think I mightn't even touch it." Now you start to know all those things. You think, I wonder, could we just have left it? But then I think back and think, actually, there was more than 50% of your prostate had cancer in it, and you had a positive margin. What would you do if someone told you that? Didn't you probably have your prostate removed?
And your PSA was rising.
And the PSA was rising, absolutely.
Clear indicator.
Absolutely. Yeah. And actually, even after the surgery, your PSA is rising. You're thinking, give me the treatment, please, quickly. Just get that's kind of where I'm at. So it's okay in the old sunny afternoons now, when you're 4.5 years past it, to say, "Oh, I wonder could I have done that. I wonder could I have done that." But in reality, I made the decisions I made. And they probably were the right decisions at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. And like, Paul, you've talked, I really appreciate you talking very openly about your erectile dysfunction and your incontinence. And I suppose The next question I would ask you is, have you fully recovered from your incontinence at this stage?
Yeah, given that you had two treatments. I'm fully continent. I'm going to say fully continent. There are moments, and maybe even like just moments that catch me by surprise. I don't wear pads or anything anymore. I might have all the pads and I'm functioning. But there's sometimes I might be some. Maybe if you're out having a drink or you're out with the friends and things, and I think, oh, hang on, so I'm not going to control this. I'm getting to the bathroom quickly here. So I have a bit of that. But in reality, that bit all feeds back to normal for me. But actually, what's not is I have little or no libido, and I've been sent for referrals for, I read about it in the book, for penile implants, for penis pumps, for bits and pieces. And there's some, I tried to write some of the darker bits in the book, actually, about going upstairs and your waist downstairs and pumping up your penis before you snap a ring on you at the end of your, it's a, the guy when he tells you about it, it all sounds very sensible. When you're trying to do it yourself, it's bloody, it's really gruesome. And I didn't like that. And in the end, and now I'm on injection therapy, which kind of works, So after 4 years or 5 years, spontaneity's out the window. I get that, but actually there is that ability to be intimate with my wife and if I was being really, really blunt, I'm very lucky and I'm very blessed that I have a wife who has been, we've been together since she was 13, I was 14 as kids.
Sweethearts. Childhood sweethearts.
We got together and we celebrated our, I think I don't know what it was, what many years it is now, maybe 39 years, whatever, our wedding anniversary just recently. But if I hadn't got her and I was a single man and I was trying to navigate the world as a single man, I think I'd be a bit crushed at the moment, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. And actually, you know, Paul, it's really nice that you acknowledge that, because like there's such a comfort and security in long-term relationships, you know. And I know, I'm delighted Geraldine is going to be on with us soon, because prostate cancer is a disease of relationships, you know. There's intimacy, you know, everything is challenged in this space where everything was okay. And I think, you know, that it's so good to acknowledge that for other people who may not be in the space that you're in, like maybe seeking a new relationship or maybe in a relationship that's fragmented at the moment because of a cancer diagnosis and because of everything that's happening. It is nice, I think, to acknowledge that it is difficult.
Well, 35 years married. I think Geraldine probably, I can speak for herself. We weren't exactly love's young dream. It wasn't, but we still. I still, as a man, I still want to have that intimate. I think as a human being, we all want intimacy. We all need. I certainly don't want to be needy about it, but I need human contact in life. And after the surgery, and after the radiotherapy and things, it's me that's the one who's reticent about it, because I feel like well, I'm not what I was before. I look where I am and I think, and I write about it in the book, I felt like I was left with like just a shriveled mess, and I think, well, who wants to be intimate with that person? And who, and that's, so I think if Geraldine can speak for herself when she comes on, but I think the biggest challenges for me, Alan, and still the biggest challenges, and I'm still going through it, are the mental challenges or the mental turmoil you put yourself through. But actually, it's left me as a very different human being. And on the surface, I walk into a room and people see the same Paul that they saw 10 years ago. I'm not the same. I have to work through that so I can be the best dad that I can be to my kids, and I'm not moping about. And I can recognize the good place I'm in when lots of men don't get to be in that place. And I have to tell myself that sometimes, being brutally honest, sometimes I feel pretty sorry for myself, and I'm sorry to say it, but I do.
I think that's okay.
Well, I had a heart attack at 48 and cancer at 51, and I think that's a pretty tough hand to deal with for anybody. And then I think actually the heart attack didn't kill you, you're very fortunate, and the prostate cancer hasn't, and you're very fortunate. And we're off on holiday in 2 weeks' time as a family with my granddaughter, with all my family, and that's an experience that some men never get.
Yeah, and I think, don't be so hard on yourself, Paul, because it has been a very difficult road, and it is, prostate cancer can be a difficult road, you know, in terms of those unwanted effects that you're talking about, the real quality of life issues.
Yes.
You know, the intimacy, the manhood, those feelings are like what you know best in your life. You grew up with them. And I suppose the one thing I would like to ask you, though, Paul, is, you know, in all of that, are you able to seek, you know, further expertise and support in terms of dealing with the mental, you know, the psychological issues that it has left you with?
A couple of times I've kind of, and it is there. This help is there for anybody listening. That psychological, that mental support, and that is there. It's definitely there. Mm. I read about in the book, Alan, the oncologist I get on with really, really well. And there was one point that I was a really low point about 2 or 3 years ago, sitting in front of him, and I read about being really low and feeling just dreadful. And this very kind man, who's becoming a really good person in my life, just said, anyway, besides all of that, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. And the biggest lie in the world. I mean, it's the most two words in the world, I'm fine. Honestly. Mm-hmm. And then I write in the book what I really was feeling, which was far from fine. But I didn't take the opportunity. And I know the opportunities are there. If I'm feeling particularly, in my case, rightly or wrongly, if I'm feeling particularly down, I'll write a book about it, which is what I did. And the book's been a real help for me, because I wrote a book just to bear away some of the pain. The book got rid of most of the pain and got most of it out there, stuff that I wasn't able to say to people. And the book is incredibly intimate and incredibly, incredibly raw. And it is deliberately so. And I've had lots of family members who say, I felt really uncomfortable reading that. And because, mm-hmm. and I said, well, yes, but men need to talk about, I need you. And some of that's about the mental turmoil I've been in, because they see me as, you introduced me at the start of the podcast as, rightly or wrongly, a footballer, physiotherapist, a barrister, a CEO, an author. Someone sees that beside your name and they think, wow, this guy's a high flyer. Well, actually, yeah. This guy might be a high flyer, but he's in a bit of pain at times as well. He's trying to work through it. So this morning before I spoke to you, I went for a run up a hill, mm-hmm. which I do most mornings, because I've never felt bad after that. I've never felt Mm-hmm. I've always felt mentally stronger after exercise, without question, and I feel really empowered that I can write.
Yeah, it's a great gift, Paul.
Yeah, do I think I need some? They're just outlets. They're ways of and out. But actually, there has been help there for me when I've been down, and I haven't taken it, and I should have taken it.
Okay, and would you consider it like going forward?
I would. I have no reticence about doing it. I just never. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm never very good at. Never been very good at pushing myself forward. If you were in trouble, I'd be very good at helping you. If Geraldine was in trouble, I'd be very good at doing that. But myself, sometimes not as good, not as proactive as I should be.
Yeah, a little bit of self compassion and self.
Yeah, I'm harsh on myself. I think maybe too harsh. Maybe Geraldine might agree with that or disagree with that. I think I'm too harsh sometimes, and I understand that.
Yeah,
I've been that way all my life.
And. Look, I mean, I think you've been through, you know, an awful lot in life. But as you say, you're very grateful, and that gratefulness is shining through there. There is that side of looking after yourself and giving yourself a little bit of self-compassion.
Yeah, and there are other things that have happened. Just and I write again. I was writing about the magic of the tin. About we have a granddaughter who came along in the same month I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And for all the grandparents out there that know this, I'm sure it's the same for everyone. It hit me like a thunderbolt in terms of what I felt for this child. Her picture, her photograph, she thinks the book's her book because it's called The Magic in the Tin, and she goes to school, she's only five. And now, she's coming to our house today, and it sounds cliched. When that happens, I clear the decks, and whatever she says she wants to do, that's what I'll do. And then we just do it. So okay. She wants to walk in the forest, that's what we'll do. She wants to play in the living room and make a terrible mess, that's what we'll do. And for a moment, you can't ever, I don't think it's very hard to be unhappy or be down when you're playing with a child in a living room with toys. I find it impossible to be miserable.
You're expressing that unconditional love that is so empowering. Geraldine, Paul's wife, is joining us now. Geraldine, lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here, I think.
Yeah, we've mentioned your name a lot of times through our conversation. Yeah, so I think we already know, and all the listeners know how important you have been in Paul's life, and vice versa, of course. Geraldine, like we're acknowledging very strongly here for Paul, for yourself, and for the listeners, that prostate cancer is a disease, you know, of relationships, really. I think in your own case, you've been together a long time, which is probably a real bonus here as well. You know each other so well. So there's a really strong, I suppose, relationship there already. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it would be lovely for us to hear, Geraldine, how it was for you, you know, when Paul was diagnosed at 51 with prostate cancer, had a surgery, came out the other side, but then had to deal with all the unwanted and lingering effects, I suppose, and the effects that are still there in your relationship. How was all that for you?
Difficult, because as the partner, it's very difficult because I'm watching the person I love go through lots of awful stuff, and I'm totally helpless. You're almost a bystander because absolutely nothing that you can do to help him. And usually if something happens to your partner, you know, you can give them support, you can make it better. But in this case, for this instance, there's nothing that I could do to make it go away or better. Or yes, I can give comfort, but it's almost as if it isn't happening to you. You're standing by watching this happening, but you've got no control over it. You've got no idea what at that point what the future holds, and you're just going through the motions, really, I would say. And it's really hard. It is hard, but we're here.
You're here. Yeah. And how did you manage, I suppose, you know, Paul would probably, he didn't use the word rock, but that's what it feels like. You were his rock through this, you know. You were there for him. Despite, you know, a lot of issue, you know, the unwanted lingering effects of an intimate relationship, but really trying to build on that. You know, how did you feel you could and did support Paul in that space?
Again, you kind of feel that you feel guilty because you do support them to a point, but part of you can't give them all the support that he needs, you know, that you know, because he's going through so much, there's nothing I can do to give him comfort. And that's the hardest bit, really. That's there because I want to, you know, and I want to support him, and we are different to what we were. We've worked our way through things. But for Paul, Paul's not the same person either. And on the outside, he'll say to people, oh, yeah, I'm fine. And he's, you know, laughing and joking with people and telling them his funny stories and talking about his books. But underneath that, I can see that he's not the same person. And he puts a very brave front on things. But you're just a bystander. You feel like a real bystander.
Just for the record, she's not a bystander. She's far from that. She's underplaying, which is typical of her. She's underplaying the support. So you don't have to. She's not a bystander. She's far from it.
I think like we know that. We can see that, and we've heard it. And Geraldine, I know it can be a little bit emotional, you know, when you start talking and your partner is beside you. But the reality is, you've been in this together. Intimacy has changed. Your relationship has changed, but you're still together, and still working it out, as you say. So it's work in progress, over many years, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing has been the books. The books have been a massive, like a really excellent outlet for Paul. But even things like, I mean, I'm a teacher, so lots of my friends. I mean, obviously, I don't come in and talk about intimate details of my life. So lots of my friends at school have read the book and they've come and they went, oh, gosh, we had no idea you were going through that. And so, because it is a private thing, you know.
It is, of course.
I'm proud of him that he's put it out there and told other people what it's like. Because when you get your initial diagnosis, you don't hear all the side effects or all the things that could happen. Basically, somebody's told you you've got cancer and you want rid of it. And that's the end goal, really. You don't hear all the other things that the doctor's saying to you at the time.
That's right. And we talked about that earlier on, Paul and I, and it was about cutting it out, getting rid of it. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of deal with the consequences of incontinence and erectile dysfunction afterwards.
Obviously, you've spoken to him now, I haven't heard what's gone before, but he's a funny man, you know, that's why.
Yeah.
For a while, but you know, he's a funny man.
Not funny, strange, by the way, just funny, just...
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, so he will make light of things, and he will, you know, joke about things, and that's one of his qualities that he can do that. But then the other side is in his darker moments when he's annoyed at himself or he's angry at himself or he's worried about things. You know, it's just it's difficult. You know,
yeah.
And he's totally had the rug pulled out from underneath him. And for that, sometimes yes, sometimes I'm angry about that, that somebody's done that to him, or, you know, and we question all the time, did it have to be like this? You know, maybe if we'd had more information to begin with, you know, things might be different. But, you know, things, it is what it is. And, that you know, we're a happy couple. We love each other, and we're, you know, we do all the things. And like you said, Isla, our granddaughter, is an amazing little thing. We've got a really lovely family. We're, you know, from the outside looking in, people think, oh, you've got an amazing life. You've got this. You've got that. You know, but it is. It's tricky sometimes. But,
yeah, and I think what we would do here is acknowledge that for both of you. You know. And allow yourselves the bad days. And but I suppose one thing I was talking to Paul about there, you know, just before you came on, Geraldine, was that, you know, being hard on himself, and maybe just that little bit of you know, well, he's certainly aware, but talking about you now, Paul, but that self-compassion, you know, just, you know, loving yourselves a little bit more in that space, and allowing that, but also allowing and acknowledging the bad days, you know, because people have bad days, of course, and good days.
Yeah.
And externally, everything looks okay, you know. Mm-hmm. Geraldine, as a wife, what would your message be to women or men or listening in today? You know, we look at all communities here, partners, wives. So having been alongside Paul for the last probably 6 years in the prostate cancer journey, what would be a message you'd like to send out to those supporting their partners with prostate cancer?
I think we all think we're invincible and we will cope with anything that life throws at us. But I think for people going through cancer issues, I don't think there's any support for people, really, any support that, or advice for us, we would have to actively seek it out. And we think, oh, we're too intelligent people, we don't need to seek advice for that, we can do that ourselves. So don't think that you have to do everything by yourself, even though I've never taken my own advice. I think you should do your research and find out more before you make decisions about what's going to happen in your life. I think probably would be the big thing, and just take every day as it comes.
And Paul, for you, what would be your, I suppose, the message that you'd like our listeners to take home loud and clear from today's conversation?
I think you mentioned a couple of times, I think the realization that I am too hard on myself, and I expect too much from myself. I expect that actually that I have the ability to overcome anything is what I think about. And actually sometimes I'm overwhelmed, and it's okay to be overwhelmed.
And it is okay to be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And we interviewed a gentleman with stage 4 prostate cancer, and we ended it. And I think we'll end this session today by saying it's okay not to be okay. Yeah.
And also you can be grateful for where you're at in life still. I know it sounds when you have your moments of your dying moments. Actually, in 2 weeks' time, we're heading off on a beautiful family holiday together, and we'll make some great memories there.
I think it's a great way to end our session. I absolutely loved talking to Paul and Geraldine. I think it's so important for you to come together and share your story. And I wish you the best, and I hope you have the most beautiful holiday. And as you said, Paul, make some beautiful memories, you know.
Absolutely.
Memories are forever. And it was a real pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
No, it was a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thank you once again to our brilliant guest speakers for their insight, to our sponsors Janssen for their support in making this series possible, and to all of you for tuning in. Join us next time, where we will once again be talking all about prostate cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more on Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Tune in next time, but until then, have a great week.